ever since human beings figured out there were other planets in our galaxy, some have wondered, is there life on those other planets? With the latest technology and a growing body of research, we know the answer is maybe. But our next guest says there's good news. Even if answers seem to be eternally around the corner, the search for ways to detect life in the universe tells us a lot about ourselves and the planet we live on. In her new book, she explores the worlds and science of science and science fiction, research and imagination to learn more about what makes life on Earth unique, at least so far. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. What is your favorite portrayal of alien life in a science fiction book or movie? Do you think there's life on other planets? And do you have questions for our guest about the different kinds of research looking for that kind of life? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jamie Green's a science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you spend a lot of time talking to actual scientists in the book, but you also focus a lot on science fiction and imagination when it comes to what alien life might be. Why was that such an important factor for what you wrote?
The way that I wanted to approach things in the book was not just looking at sci-fi as imaginings and science as potential facts, but as all of this as like one big imaginative project. And so I think that like putting the science and the sci-fi together shows us all the different ways that we imagine the possibilities of life beyond Earth. And it's obvious that science fiction is imaginative, but if you look at science also, like even something as fundamental as making a hypothesis is a kind of imagination. It's about prediction and thinking, you know, what might happen. And designing an experiment requires a lot of imagination. And so I wanted to look at the different angles that we come at this question from.
But the big disconnect I see between science and science fiction is I look at a science fiction universes like those of Star Wars and Star Trek, and it's full of teeming with life. It's everywhere you look, it seems like. Every, you know, planet has some sort of trouble that Captain Kirk needs to find a way out of. So why might life be less abundant than science fiction would like to imagine?
Well, I mean, yeah, science fiction is full of life because otherwise it would be some pretty boring stories. It's like, oh, we were in a spaceship for 3 years and then we turned around and came home, which granted, there are some amazing stories that are like that too, but those are stories about people, you know. I mean, first of all, there's the fact that we haven't found anything yet, that no one has shown up on our doorstep. Of course, there are lots of reasons for that. It could be like in Star Trek, there's this rule about the prime directive. And if we haven't reached a sufficient technology level yet, everyone's just kind of going to leave us alone to find our own path. There's also the possibility that life is just pretty rare. There are scientific reasons for this. You know, it seems like life on Earth did emerge pretty quickly in terms of, you know, once the environment was what life needed, life showed up pretty quick. But that was simple life. That was simple single-celled life like bacteria. And then it took another 2 billion years, that's billion with a B, for life to evolve complexity. And I don't just mean multicellularity. I mean complexity within a cell, structures like the nucleus, which then made it possible for various reasons for life to evolve into structural complexity, into multicellular organisms with bodies and, you know, plants and animals and all of that. 2 billion years is a lot of rolling the dice and waiting for the lucky things to happen that made that possible. And the more we learn about how life figured out that kind of structural complexity, it seems like it might have been kind of a fluke.
So, Jamie, I'm curious about this running theme in your book, that even if we don't discover life outside of Earth anytime soon, it raises big questions about life here on Earth, about humanity itself, us. What are some of your favorite earthly discoveries that have come from the search for alien life?
Ooh, that's a really cool question. I can sort of answer that personally, where I set out to write a book about the search for life beyond Earth, and in the process, learned a ton about life on Earth myself. You know, I came at this with more of a background in astronomy. I'm not a scientist. I'm a writer by training, but I had been writing about astronomy and exoplanets and things like that for years. Biology, on the other hand, was pretty new to me. I took it in high school, but I had never really written about it. And so in order to understand the ways we imagine life on other worlds, and in order to like figure out the right questions to ask, I had to learn about things like convergent evolution, which is the phenomenon we see on Earth that distantly related organisms often will evolve similarly, you know, whether it's the body shapes of dolphins and sharks, they found that independently, or human eyes and octopus eyes are structurally very similar and evolve totally independently. This is one of the most interesting questions in evolution. Is this convergence where separate organisms, separate branches of the tree of life come up with the same solutions to the problems of evolution, how to use light to see your environment, how to swim, how to fly? Is that the rule, or are those just interesting exceptions and evolution is really random? You know, an ancient fish had eaten that worm instead of the other worm, everything would have turned out differently, you know? And we really don't know this. It's a huge debate in evolutionary biology. And so I think that's a really cool open question that reveals so much about life on Earth and the sort of meaning that we make of it, and is also vital to how we imagine life on other worlds, because we'd be completely unrelated. You know, a shark and a dolphin, you go far enough back, they do have a common ancestor. But me and an alien on another world, no common ancestor. Is there reason to think that they would look like us, walk like us, think like us? It all comes back to these questions of how evolution works.
Jamie Green, science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. Brian and Madison, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to ask, so I recently read Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama, which is a fantastic book. And it's all about just the main conflict is trying to learn as much as we can before time runs out. I think a more like up-to-date version of that would be the movie Arrival. The main conflict is just we don't have much time to try to figure this out. There's no actual like conflict, like space fights. So I just wanted to ask, why is that construct more rare in science fiction as opposed to like your Star Wars is? And what does that say about us?
Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, that is an awesome question. And I definitely think that Arrival, or the story that it's based on, The Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang, fits into that. I also think Stanislav Lem's Solaris fits into that as well, where the alien presence, the alien entity, is unknowable. And that's a big part of it. And it's about humans trying to bridge this impossible-to-bridge gap. And I think we don't see that very often because those stories are, they're not as dynamic. They're not big battle set pieces. It was an amazing fluke that Arrival was as big a hit as it was, because it's a quiet, weird movie. And in the story, you don't ever find out why the aliens came at all. They're completely opaque and unknowable, and even more so for Solaris, where no one can communicate with this alien entity. I think we want stories very often about relationships between people, whether those people are human or alien. You know, we all learn in elementary school that conflict is the foundation of narrative, and it can be person to person or person against themselves, et cetera, et cetera. These stories with an unknowable alien, it's like person against a brick wall. And that's fascinating. And it can be very poetic and very moving, but it's especially for movies. And I know there have been like multiple film adaptations of Solaris. People figure it out. But it's not the sort of traditional story, conflict-driven story arc that we're used to.
Jamie Green, our guest, and we're taking a look at life out there and life right here in our backyard. She is the author of the new book, the possibility of life, science, imagination, and our quest for kinship in the cosmos. We'll take your calls, want to hear from you. How likely do you think it is that there is life on other planets, and how far away might it be? How about intelligent life on other planets? And do you have a favorite science fiction version of what alien life might be like? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. We continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our conversation about the search for life outside the universe, lessons from science and science fiction, and what it tells us about what it means to be human. Jamie Green, our guest, her new book is The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Let's continue with your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Dan in La Crosse is standing by. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon. Regarding science, the American Scientific Affiliation. Regarding literature, C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy. Regarding poetry, my poem, Evolve Me Jesus. And regarding music, the Martian spaceship landed, aliens said please, take us to your Sparta butter, Westby cottage cheese, and the cheddar moon. Cheddar moon.
Dan from La Crosse giving us a message to those and mentioning Westby, which I think it was a Wisconsin original. It reminds me of some of the songs we've sent out into space and some of the signals we've sent to try to contact any life that might be out there, Jamie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is hot debate about whether we should be sending signals, not only listening for them. You know, since about 1960, on and off, we've been searching for radio signals that we might receive either intentionally sent or sort of overheard from other technological civilizations. But there have also been some messages sent out. Some of them were beamed radio messages, like the Arecibo message, which was sent out from the Arecibo telescope long before it unfortunately collapsed in the last couple of years. And we've also sent some physical messages, like the Voyager Golden Records. These were literal golden phonograph records, just like a message in a bottle that were stuck to the side of the Voyager probes that were launched in 1977. And this was a project overseen by Carl Sagan when NASA realized that these probes, after they completed their observational mission in the outer solar system, were just going to keep going. And so Sagan and his eventual wife, Andrian, and another and a small team put together this record of images, some scientific diagrams, some pictures of life on Earth, and music and whale song and greetings in 150 language. There's also a recording of a child's laughter. It was Sagan's young son, and a recording of Andrian's brainwaves while she did an hour-long meditation on the state of our planet and humanity's struggles against, you know, our violent tendencies and all the hope that she felt for us nonetheless.
Dan, if the aliens land, I'm sending them straight to you in La Crosse. Thank you for the call. Jamie Green, our guest, let's continue with your calls now. Ryan in Glendale joins us. Ryan, good afternoon.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's a really provocative discussion. One of my favorite science fiction stories is Contact by Carl Sagan.
Yes.
And I really appreciate it because it looks at both sides of these implications of contacting other life forms, both the scientific and the faith side. And it doesn't come down on either side. It doesn't treat it as a zero-sum game. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on some of the philosophical implications of life on other planets.
Brian, thank you. And Jamie, you write about this in The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos.
Yeah, I mean, Contact is definitely one of the... Carl Sagan is obviously a huge presence in the book and an inspiration to me, and especially through Contact, because I agree, it's a fascinating imagined version of what might happen and how Sagan thought it might happen and what it might mean to humans. And it's also his way of grappling with the power that the religious right had in politics at the time, as well as our search for some sort of spiritual meaning through science. And what's fascinating to me is that at the end of the book, this isn't really a spoiler, and also the book is very old, so I trust that I'm not ruining anything. But we sort of, we get this direct proof that in a way, in the world of the book, God is real, that a message has been encoded in the digits of pi, which means that, like, there is a message in the fabric of the universe. And I actually write about this in the book, that when I encountered that, I was like, that's really weird. Sagan's been writing against the sort of, you know, religious struggle against science. And he's very much interested in looking for the numinous, the meaningful, the spiritual. But, like, why would you say God is real? And I actually, I was able to talk to Andrew and his widow and collaborator on Contact and Cosmos and many other projects. And she said that it's about looking for that sense of meaning and connection that we can find through science, through understanding the universe more deeply, that it's not a religious God, it's not a human God, but it's the sense that there is something deeper than we can comprehend, but it's accessible through science and math.
Sounds like you're describing quantum physics.
Yeah, a little bit.
Rich in Two Rivers joins us next. Rich, you're on the air with Jamie Green.
Hey, Jamie. I'm interested in something I just read about recently, which is Mars was actually occupied by, it had a living biosphere, and they're picking up radio isotopes that they can't pick, you don't pick up unless there was nuclear warfare. And the next claim was they ended up going to the Earth because of the planet was destroyed.
That we are the Martians and that Mars was blown up by a nuclear war. Does this say more about us or life elsewhere outside of planet Earth, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with any sort of scientific consensus about there being proof of a past nuclear war on Mars. It sounds like, you know, some of the ways that we try to make sense of anomalous findings, you know, when we find radioisotopes that don't quite make sense, it looks like what nuclear war looks like. But there are so many chemical and geological phenomena that we don't know about yet. So this is one of those questions of imagination, that when we see something truly strange, we sort of interpret it like a mirror through the lens of our own experience. You know, so far there has been no solid evidence of life found on Mars. There have been false alarms. There have been anomalous findings that have yet to be fully resolved. But we haven't found evidence yet. And we've found proof that there is some ice. There was probably more water in the past, which is really promising, but we haven't found anything yet.
Jamie, we have heard a lot recently about artificial intelligence, ChatGPT. How does machine intelligence play a role in our search for life elsewhere and what it says about us?
I think the way that it's going to be most useful is that these machine learning algorithms are fantastic at recognizing patterns in ways that humans can't. And so there's work being done now about using machine learning programs to sift through past SETI observations of radio signals from the cosmos in case there's a possible pattern or signal or proof of technological origin that human searching hasn't been able to find. There's also work using machine learning to figure out possible signs of life in terms of chemistry that's different from Earth's life. So even though it won't look familiar to us, machine learning can say this would be the signature of complex living chemistry in this very alien, in this very alien environment. There is also the question of if we were to find advanced aliens, would they have transcended biology to become a sort of machine intelligence, you know, whether it's that they've created machine intelligence far beyond, you know, ChatGPT, that then replaced the biological intelligence, or did they upload their consciousness into eternal machines, or are they the biological aliens hanging out at home while they send their robot scouts out into the cosmos, because, you know, robots are a lot less bothered by space travel than bodies are.
Drones.
Yeah, totally.
Jamie Green, our guest, the book, The Possibility of Life's Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Could it be possible that alien life is hiding from us? You mentioned Dyson spheres in your book, Jamie.
Yeah, so Dyson spheres are this idea that were popularized and named after the astronomer, mathematician, polymath Freeman Dyson, which actually come from a science fiction novel from 1937 called Star Maker that I love and was so glad to discover because of this. So Dyson pointed out that a very advanced civilization would need more power to fuel their technology. And the way that they might achieve this would be to get all of the energy given off by their star instead of just what lands on a planet. And to do that, you build a sphere or a spherical swarm of satellites all the way around the star to catch all of its energy. Again, this sort of, as you can tell, started in science fiction. Mm-hmm. And Dyson was just saying, this could be a thing to look for. And so sure enough, maybe a little less than 10 years ago, an astronomer at Penn State named Jason Wright said, okay, I'm going to look for it. And he did a research survey where he was looking at other galaxies, because he figured if you're powerful enough to build one Dyson sphere, you're probably powerful enough to spread throughout the galaxy and, you know, start siphoning off from a lot of stars.
Jamie, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Jamie Green, science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos.